Welcome to Changemaker with founder of Gypsy Tea and social entrepreneur Zina Muzika.
This new podcast is to help you embrace change and experience amazing people and entrepreneurs. We're going to be sharing secrets, habits, and change-making abilities with you so that you can apply them to your life and make a life of your dreams.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzika.
Hi, Changemakers. Welcome to another exciting episode of Changemaker. Today, I am really thrilled. I'm trying not to be too excited and sound shaky, but I have loved this book, The Diamond Cutter. It has really shaped how I do business. It's shaped how I raise my kids. It's shaped so much of how I create relationships in the world. And to share it with you is very exciting. We have the author today, Geshe Michael Roach. He's the founder and CEO of the Diamond Cutter Institute, and he can be found on Facebook at Geshe Michael. I can be found at Zina, Z-H-E-N-A. Geshe Michael Roach was born in California and graduated from Princeton University with honors. He received the Presidential Scholar Medallion from the President of the United States at the White House in the 70s. He's the first American to complete and receive the Geshe, Buddhist equivalent of a PhD degree, after 25 years of study with Sarah May Buddhist Monastery in India. He then helped to found Andan International Diamond Corporation in New York City, which grew from a small investment to $250 million in annual sales and was purchased in 2009 by super investor Warren Buffett. So you know it was highly profitable. Geshe Michael's profits from Andan International were used to create and support nonprofit organizations which employ refugees to rescue, scan and translate rare decaying classics which would otherwise be lost, and make them available to the world free of charge. Geshe Michael recently received an honorary PhD doctorate degree from the National University of Mexico. He also received the graduate gemologist degree from the Gemological Institute of America and the fellow of the Gemological Association degree. Oh, these are mouthfuls, Geshe Michael, from the Gemological Association of Great Britain, the two highest degrees in the world for the science of diamonds and gemstones. He has written many books about Asian culture and philosophy, including The Diamond Cutter, which explains how the growth and smashing success of Andan International were produced using the wisdom learned in the monastery. And so we're going to talk about The Diamond Cutter. And so tell me, how did you go from a Buddhist scholar to a diamond dealer?
Oh, it's a funny story. So I did spend about 25 years studying in the monastery, Tibetan monastery. And then the last 3 weeks is the final examination for a degree called the Geshe. And that examination is held in a strange way. It's held in a public park inside the monastery, an open courtyard. And then for many hours in the day and also in the night, you have to defend your ideas orally in Tibetan language against all comers. And in my monastery, there are over 1,000 monks would come and question you and in public. And then you have to answer from memory, from the ancient books. And then you have to jump around because it's all done in a martial arts style. So,
so you're good under pressure, I take it.
You practice for many years. You practice for 3 or 4 hours a day for 25 years. And then the final exam, the final, it takes place on the last day. And you go into the main temple and you are questioned by the elders in public. And then if you succeed, then you get that big yellow hat that you wear on top of your head that looks like a Greek soldier's hat. Yes. And they don't give you really a paper in those days, just the hat. And then you're supposed to go back to your little monk cell and have some Tibetan salt tea and just relax for the rest of your life and teach the little monks. But I got a message from the abbot of the monastery, and he asked me to come to his quarters. And then he said, well, congratulations, you're the first Westerner to finish, but for you, we have a second examination. And then I said, well, you didn't mention a second examination. He said, well, because you're the first Western person, we would like to give you a practical examination. And we want, you know, we've been teaching you for many years, basically how reality works, how to adjust or tweak reality. It's a lot like the Matrix. And then we want to give you a practical test to see if you can actually do it. So we want you to go to New York and start a diamond business and, you know, see if you can make $1 million in 1 year, just using karma. And we'll donate the money to the refugees. And so that's how it started. It was sort of a challenge.
How did you feel in that moment? Did you feel like it was possible?
No, I felt upset. I didn't want to go to New York because I knew New York, and I didn't. The reason I was in a monastery is I didn't like New York and I didn't like business, and I was kind of upset for a few months, and I sort of resisted it. But there's a very strict code of discipline in the monastery, so if they ask you to do something, you have to do it. And so I went, and I personally only had a few dollars at the time. I bought a suit at the Goodwill, and. And we started, and then we just applied these ancient principles that are they're in a book called The Diamond Cutter, it's the oldest printed book in the world. It was first taught 2,500 years ago. And then we just started using that in our company. We started with 3 people, and I think by the peak it was up to about 10,000 people.
Wow. So tell me exactly, our listeners who may not have read the book, tell me what the principles are of the Diamond Cutter.
I think the most important principle is what you could call karma. But, you know, I grew up in America. My mom talked about karma. She said, just don't step on bugs because you might get in a car accident or something. And, you know, we didn't know what it was and we didn't know how it worked. But basically, in the monastery, over many years of study, you learn that everything you do or say or think is recorded in your subconscious. It makes an imprint on your mind, almost as if you're pressing your thumb into your palm. And then that imprint becomes a seed. And then perhaps weeks later or months later, that seed will open in the subconscious and it will color how you see reality. It will decide what you see around you. So in the case of business, the theory is that if you help someone else start a business, or if you help someone else be more profitable, make money in their business, then while you're talking to them and while you're trying to help them, those intentions and those words, you hear them in your mind, and then that creates a seed in your mind. And then if the seed is watered properly and taken care of, nurtured properly, then it will open into a very successful business. So that's what happened to us.
Beautiful. So tell me, why diamonds? Why of all the things in the world, why a diamond? And I do have a good friend, Jess Mahari, who's a jewelry designer for the Sundance catalog, and I gave her the book. I've given it to a lot of friends who are jewelry designers, and it gave them such an incredible sense of purpose with working with diamonds. Yeah. So tell us how the diamond cutter, you know, came to be, and why diamonds of all things?
It's a great question, and people don't ask it very often. So that book, this ancient book that was taught by the Buddha 2,500 years ago, he named it the Diamond Cutter. But inside the book, which explains how the Golden Rule works, there's no mention of diamonds, and there's no mention of diamond cutters. And so in the monastery, I would spend a lot of time asking my teachers what's so important about the diamond. And it's a very important symbol or metaphor in meditation or in Buddhism, because the diamond is the hardest thing in the universe. So nothing can scratch a diamond. In fact, when you cut a diamond, you have to use another diamond. So there's no physical object in the whole universe which can scratch a diamond, and except for another diamond. So in our teaching or in our training, we're taught that the diamond is very similar to an idea called emptiness. And this is the idea that, you know, if you were trained really well in how to plant these seeds to create, say, business success around you, or a successful marriage or something like that, or how to find a partner by planting a seed, and if you got good at it, And we train people to do that. But if you got good at it, then you would start to think that there's nothing in the world that is not created by seeds in your mind. And and that's called emptiness. So that idea that there's nothing, for example, there's no business that ever existed that wasn't successful at some level because the people in charge of the business helped other people and made other people successful. So if you tried to find a business in the world that was successful for any other reason, you would come up blank. And that blank is called emptiness in Buddhism. And that the closest thing in the natural world to that emptiness is a diamond. So the whole exercise of being in the diamond business was just a metaphor for that. And it was just to make me remember every few minutes about that idea that nothing comes from nothing. And nothing comes from... Everything comes from being good to others.
Yeah, and what I love too, how you explained the diamond is that when it's raw, it just looks like a piece of dirt. You know, it just, but the polishing and the actual cutting of it and the energy that has to go into it to make it shimmer and make it shine and reflect light is so impactful. But also what I loved is that, you know, a sheet of diamond just looks like glass. It's actually the cutting of it, and it is just pure potential.
Yeah, I saw a diamond, a very large diamond. There were two stones in New York being cut by a friend of mine, and he was cutting them in a very strange way, as a flat, you know, as like a tablet shape or a pill shape. And I asked him, what are you doing? Why are you ruining this huge diamond? It was maybe 10 or 15 carats. And he said, I've got a contract with NASA to create a window for a satellite. And that window, in 1979, it did fly in the satellite to Venus, and it can withstand temperatures up to almost 4,000 degrees. Wow. And it's perfectly clear. So the idea is that although there's this potential all around us all the time, that we could make anything happen that we want to just by helping others to get what they want to, it's invisible to most of us all the time. We don't see it. So that's the idea.
I felt that I'd never, people would say, how did you build a multimillion-dollar business? Single mom, $6 to your name, how did you do it? And I never really had an answer. I just would say I was single-minded. I needed to get my son his operations. And then I needed to end poverty for tea workers, give them a voice. I never understood what that was. But when I sat down to write my book, I realized with a mission to serve, you cannot fail. And the last chapter in my book was from a tea estate manager who owns an estate in Sri Lanka. All of his, he's fair trade and he gives so much to his workers. And I said, what's going to happen when they're all so educated, they don't want to do the physical labor anymore of plucking tea? He said, well, we're planning on giving them each their land and then they'll become business owners. And then they can use their education to manage their business and we'll buy the tea from them. And I thought, generosity eliminates fear. And so can you talk a little bit about how if we need something, we just give it to somebody else. But there's another step that I never actually did was actually to think about and reflect on and be happy about what I did. I never did that. I always thought, well, I'm going to end poverty for tea workers. I'm going to help people. Anytime someone would say, oh, that's a great job, good job, I'd go, no, no, there's too much more to do. Don't praise me. Like, I'm nothing because, but you say to actually give people things that you yourself need and then reflect on it. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this comes from a teaching. You know, we were required to memorize many books and study many ancient books, and this comes from a very famous Buddhist book from about 17 centuries ago called Abhidharma Kosha. And in that book, in the fourth chapter, is about seeds, mental seeds. And in that book, he outlines different steps for planting a seed in your mind purposely. And I used to, you know, I think all of us, me especially, we have trouble believing in the idea of karma or what you do comes back to you, because we see people who are very kind and who do very kind things and then who don't become successful and they don't get the things they want. So we doubt that principle. We see my mom She used to keep the door of our house open. We would never lock the door when we went to school, and she went to work as a school teacher. She would leave the door open in case someone needed something to eat or a place to stay. And but she was never wealthy, and she was never successful in a material sense. So it made me doubt, and I think all of us, we tend to doubt this principle because we can see people who do good things and don't get good things back, and we see other people who do cruel things and do get success. So we can't really commit to this idea in our own lives. So I asked my teachers in the monastery, and they gave me a very beautiful answer, which was that once you do a good deed, like helping a tea worker with a fair trade, business, then you plant a seed in your mind, and that seed will open and it will create something beautiful for you, and it cannot be destroyed by any force in the whole world. So there is a justice to life, and what you do to others will come back to you and must come back to you, and no one can change that. But the seed that you plant can stay in your mind for many years and not open. And I do a garden. I have a garden. I'm looking at my garden right now. And someone gave me an ancient Egyptian corn seed. It was, many hundreds of years old. And I watered it, and it grew. What they would say in the monastery is that all of us are doing good deeds all the time, but you have to water them. You have to give them the conditions to open. And without that, you can be kind and you can be fair to workers. You can be compassionate, but there will be no result. The seed will be there, but it will be in cold storage forever. And so,
that's a great way to put it. So actually reflecting on doing good to others is watering that seed, that imprint. I think that is a very clear way because my mom, you're talking about your mom, my mom too, she's so generous. Like if she had a dollar and anticipated you might need it, she'd just hand it to you and not even think about what her next step would be. And so I do, and I have seen her struggle with her health and with all these things, but she always felt like if we reflected on all the good things we did that was self-centered or that was egotistical or narcissistic. And so thank you for permission to do that.
The texts are very clear that it has to be done without pride. So there's a difference. I think pride is where you would get into thinking that you are the nicest person of all the nice people.
Oh, yes, of course.
But to be, to take joy in what you do. So we're required in the monastery before we go to sleep, we are supposed to think about the good deeds we've done that day. And if you're into yoga, you've heard the word prana or inner heat or something like that. And that is carried by thought or by intention. So if you think about the good things you've done for others, like I'm conducting my business in a way which is meant to help the people who supply me. I'm doing fair trade. If you reflect on that as you go to bed at night, then the thoughts carry the prana to that seed, and then the seed will open very quickly. So it's kind of a very relaxing, and it's you sleep well after you do it, and you wake up clear, and it's more of a rejoicing than an act of pride. So it's important not to be prideful about it, but. And then I've actually had people, we teach about 20,000 people a year. We just got back from China and Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou. We had 5,000 people come to the events,
Congratulations. And,
we do that every few weeks. And then people will ask me, isn't that sort of prideful? And also they will complain to me that it's too simple. They get almost disappointed that that I don't have something more complex to say than that you should enjoy the good things you're doing as you fall asleep. And then it occurred to me one day to answer them that I believe if something is very true and if it's very correct, then it should be easier.
Okay.
And if something is difficult, then it's probably not 100% correct, you see?
Agreed. So.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
You're listening to Changemaker with Zina Muzyka.
So you don't have to be a Buddhist to practice the diamond cutter.
No, we teach, there are 51 diamond cutter groups in Israel. We are going in July to Indonesia, which is, and Malaysia, which are Muslim countries. We just got back from Dubai. We even taught some of the people on the ruling council of Dubai. So they are very strict Muslims. And we teach in China, where, you know, officially people are atheists. And we teach in Russia. We teach a lot in Latin America, where people are Catholic. We were awarded a doctorate from the Congress of Mexico earlier this year. And our company, all of our, I think five or six of our company's staff gave talks in the Congress. So it's like, I think gravity, I think, you know, gravity works for whoever drops something. If you have a stone in your hand and you drop it, it doesn't matter what country you come from or what sex you are or how old you are or what religion you are. So, and I think it's compatible with every kind of religion. I think Muslim people, for example, feel very comfortable with this system because they have a similar system called zakat, where they give maybe 5 or 7% of their income to charity every year by Muslim law. So I think it just feels comfortable for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell me about that. So you're out teaching these principles in the world, and I noticed you're going to places that do have a lot of conflict and big change happening. You know, China is, you know, their economy, and there's so much happening and shifting there, and the people are unhappy. A lot of people are unhappy, or, you know, not happy with the way things are going, and class warfare, blah, blah, blah. And then the Middle East, you know, is continuously in conflict. How do you see it shifting in the world when people realize that, you know, by doing good they can excel greatly? Is it healing for them? Are they starting to make shifts that you feel will create seeds for the whole country? What is that like?
It's true. Like, I think we enjoy. There's a saying in Buddhism that the lotus grows the best in the worst smelling swamps.
Yeah.
So, and it's true. Lotuses do prefer those dirty places. So, you know, we were always encouraged in the monastery that if we were going to go to try help people, we should go to difficult places and not to easy places. So we get, you know, occasionally we get invitations to places like Paris or something like that. And we actually prefer our company. We have about 20 really fine teachers on staff, and we go to the tough places. We like to go to the tough places. So we're going to Ukraine. We just had a nice TV show. And we were talking, monitoring a conversation between Ukrainian representatives and Russian representatives. And then,
wow.
Of course, we work a lot in China. And, yeah, we just came back from the Middle East, and we were on Sky News Arabia, which is, I think, the largest TV channel in the Middle East. And what I find is that people are very, very open to this idea. I was giving a talk in South China, in Guangzhou. We don't, you know, most Americans never heard of it, but it's the largest city in the world. It's over 30 million people, and they make many of the objects in a typical American home. So
I've been there. You know. Yeah, I used to source my tins over there, and Shenzhen as well.
Yeah, so it's possible you're sitting on a chair made in Guangzhou, or you're leaning on a desk made in Guangzhou, so I was talking to a bunch of very tough businessmen in Guangzhou, very, very tough and very jaded and older and already successful, and they were all smoking cigarettes and looking at me sort of mean. And we talked for a long time about these ideas that what you do comes back to you, and how it came from China, from the diamond cutter. And then finally, towards the end of the talk, I said, well, what do you guys think would happen if it became sort of the standard in the world? or if it became the general belief that the only way to get financial success is by making other people successful, then what do you think, you know, sociologically or internationally, what would happen in the world? And I think the meanest, squinty, most squinty-eyed guy looked at me and he raised his cigarette and he just said, "World peace," you know. And I almost cried at that moment because, yeah, if it became, if all the large corporations truly believed that to succeed, you would have to help other people to succeed, then the idea of competition, I think, would become obsolete. And it's a harmful idea, I think. In the end, it causes a lot of conflict between, say, managers in the same company.
Agreed. You know, agreed.
They fight each other. And then it causes a lot of conflict between companies and between countries. And if suddenly the common view were that to get what you want, you should help someone else to get what they want, then the idea of competition would disappear. And I gave a talk to 1,500 architects in Florida, and they were all from the South, and they were pretty tough guys also. And they each one had a desk. They wanted their own desk, so 1,500 desks. And we were in a small stadium. And it was during the times that the U.S. Congress was deciding the question of whether a United States oil company, whether it should be legal to sell one to China, you see?
Yeah.
And so I gave them this long talk about how the seeds work, and we talked about how seeds are planted by helping others with what they need, and then that they multiply in the mind, and then you always get much more than you give, like exponentially more than you give. And they understood it, and they were very excited. And then the last question I gave them was, well, then what should America do about China? You know, this is our competitor. This is our big rival. Should we sell them oil companies or not? And they all started yelling, yes, yes, we should help them meet their energy needs, and then that will create more energy for America, you know, if these principles are correct.
Yeah. What about, so that's a good point. As a businesswoman, I used to be very paranoid about competition. You know, the tea industry, yeah. It was like, who needs another tea company? Not that there were belly dancers at anyone else's tea company, like mine, but I now am in corporate America. I'm part of Simon & Schuster. I have my own spirituality imprint at Atria. And I do notice, I just got back from Book Expo America, I do notice there is, even in all these different, you know, with ideas, people are competitive with ideas, as if an idea can be owned, as if it could be replicated. And I just think that moving into the 21st century and to really change the world and eradicate scarcity, we have to stop seeing competition and start looking at it as comparative, right? Like, how are they doing this so beautifully, and oh, I'd like to do something that's beautiful too with my own spin, and just really a celebration of each other's brilliance versus a, oh my God, if they have it, I can't possibly have it, I got to get my own. I think that's the most destructive thing we have in business.
I think, you know, people ask me, what's the karma for creativity? And it would be that the seed, the way you plant a seed in your mind to have the next big idea, is to congratulate and be happy about someone else having a good idea, you see? So actually being competitive about ideas is a way to stop your mind from having new creative ideas, you see?
Absolutely.
It's very, I don't know, what do you call it? It's very strange that by sharing other people's success and being joyful, especially your competitors, like congratulating them on new ideas, is the way to plant the seed to have new ideas yourself. So I think it's pretty cool. You can't have new ideas without sharing the ones you've had up to now. We, in our company, we did diamonds, but we also did a lot of innovative jewelry. We made, I think, 30,000 pieces of jewelry on a good day in New York. And, And then sometimes people would come in, and one of the salespeople would run in and say, "Look at this ring. Our competitor stole our ring." And in one case, they didn't.
Yeah.
They didn't take our trademark out of it before they cast it, you know, and so they cast it with our copyright symbol in it, and he was like screaming, and then we just looked at him, and I know the owner of the company, the main owner, he looked at him and he said, "That's last year's ring. Let them have it, you know. We're already on to next year's ring, you know."
I love it. Yeah, it's interesting with ideas, and I love that idea about creativity is, you know, instead of getting a pang when another person succeeds, jump in and actively congratulate them. I do that with beauty. You know, I turned 40 this year, and you know, 40 is a big year for women. I noticed.
But it's
like, okay, am I going to have any more kids? Am I going to this? Am I going to that? Oh, I'm getting older. Oh, look at that young, beautiful, you know, woman. And so I think in order to feel beautiful, I just started jumping in and telling every woman I saw how beautiful she was, you know, for like a whole week. And I felt younger and more energized than I did at 20. So it works.
There's a saying, you know, we believe that the seeds that are planted by telling another person, you know, how beautiful they are, that they actually shift reality. So it's not like you get more beautiful because you're not angry, or you get more beautiful because you're smiling more to beautiful people. We believe that reality itself is recast when you compliment another person who is beautiful. So it's not just that your face is less angry or has less wrinkles from scowling. It's that the karma, which is created by being happy about other people's beauty, makes you more beautiful to yourself and to others. It's cool.
It is cool. I do want to talk a little bit about, you talk about in The Diamond Cutter, this issue that ages us and causes disease, which are these diseases, quote unquote, of the mind, you know, allowing strain and worry. And I watch a lot of people burn themselves out. They work so hard. They're trying so hard to be successful and feed their family. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. There was a part in the book about becoming, you know, fat and funky and ugly by sitting at your desk all the time, and then how you can actually make yourself younger and more beautiful through your work.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think there's a lot of things about it, but most of our worries and all of our worries come from that competitive sense, right? So if we are also, time itself is like money. If we want more money, if we want our business to be financially successful, then we have to do something counterintuitive. So when you're starting a business with the purpose of making money, possibly to help your son or save your son's life, who's been born with a birth defect, and then you're focused on making the money, and you have to, you know, in the first few years of the dime business, we were up till 2 o'clock every night. Our company, the last night we were in China, we were working till 3:30 in the morning. And, you know, when you are working, when you're starting something, the last thing you want to do is give your time or money to someone else, because that's when you need it the most for yourself. But if it's true that you get what you give, then even in the startup of a business, you should try to detour some of the money that you have towards the success of other people's business. Now, when we come to time, you know, and we're stressed out, and I have children to take care of, and I have, you know, groceries to buy, and I have to decide. Right now, I'm trying to decide what to cook for dinner, you know, and then on top of that, I have to run a business. Then time becomes even more precious than funding, than capital. But you, in this system, it's very cool. Then whatever you need, you have to give some of it to someone else very consciously. So if I have a time crunch and I feel nervous or I feel anxious about time, then I should give some of my time to someone else. And that just feels wrong when you're very busy. Mm-hmm. The last thing you want to do is to give time to someone else. But in this system, we encourage business people, for example, to spend an hour a week at another company as a volunteer, to help, to give them an hour of your time. And then that seed in your mind will grow, and suddenly someone will come to you who saves you 10 hours a week or 20 hours a week.
Yeah.
And so that's the idea of that. As far as physical beauty, you know, like, am I gaining weight or am I starting to look older? The big key is to not get upset. So, you know, in this tradition, some of the seeds are obvious and some of the seeds are not obvious. So a seed which is obvious is, if I want more money, I should help other people make money. Or if I want more time, I should share my time with others. But the seed for your physical appearance, to maintain a good physical appearance, is not predictable. It's not something you would guess. And it's getting upset. So, you know, everybody knows that if you get upset a lot, like if you're driving in traffic, I tend to get upset in traffic.
I live outside of LA. Definitely happens.
But I get very upset and I'll wrinkle my forehead and I'll scowl, and then I'll come home and that will stay with me for, you know, some time. But that's not what they're talking about. In the ancient tradition, they say that the seeds planted in the mind by feelings of anger or being off balance actually affect the reality of your appearance. So, you know, a doctor will tell you don't eat this or don't eat that or eat less of this or get more exercise. But a Buddhist monk would say, watch your level of anger or how much you get upset at things like your children acting up or the traffic or the weather. And then developing your patience.
Yeah.
In your life.
That's a great beauty prescription, developing patience. Yeah. I'm going to have to take that one on with my new dog who keeps chewing my shoes.
It's more beautiful in reality. It changes the look of your face to yourself and to others. That's cool.
I love it.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzyka.
Let's finish just with money. Let's talk about warm, yummy cash instead of cold, hard cash. So you've taken a Buddhist text to help people make more money. And to help people, and this has become a great business of yours. So tell me a little bit about, I have so many friends who feel that being spiritual, they can't be in the business world or the money world. You know, it's like, okay, I'll be spiritual after I retire. Like, I'm too busy being a householder. I need to make money now and pay my bills. I want a boat. You know, how can I be both, right? So I'd love to know your thoughts on, you know, because I used to think that if I made a lot of money and somebody was starving in the world, I was wrong to make that money because I should give every single until everybody is fed, I can't enjoy wealth. So but I don't believe that anymore. But can you tell us a little bit about money and spirituality and how all of this ties together?
Oh, I like the question a lot. And I went through it also. I went through the same thing, feeling that if I were successful in a material sense, then I was somehow a failure in a spiritual sense. Mm-hmm. And that I couldn't be, I had to choose between being a successful business person or an entrepreneur and being a successful meditator or a spiritual person. And I also struggled with that. And you know, sometimes, of course, I sit and wonder why the monks sent me to New York. You know, why did they send me away? It was very painful to start a business. And why did they throw me into that such an unpleasant city and such an unpleasant business, you know, as diamonds? And I often thought about it and wondered about it. And then I think they were trying to get me to experience firsthand that you could be spiritual and successful at the same time. And over the course of my life, I'm over 60 now, and over the course of my life, I've met many, many business people. And it seems to me that the most successful ones are the ones who have a strong spiritual life also. So they don't, at some point in your life, I don't know how old you have to be, you can understand that you can have a great morning meditation. And we, you know, our company requires the employees on tour, for example, to do meditation in the morning for, you know, 45 minutes. And then we're required to do a yoga session together that can take usually about an hour. So we're required to finish our inner practices before we start work. And we're paid for it. And then that turns out to be a great combination. So as a business person, you are calm, you are healthy, you know, you are compassionate towards other people. Mm-hmm. And that turns out to be the most profitable kind of business. Then the money comes in and you have more money, and money is like fire. You have to be careful with fire, right? You can cook dinner or you can burn down the house. And money, money is like that. When the money comes back, you know, from all this karma-ing, then you have to be wise about how you use it. And I what we do in our business is we donate a lot of the money, as you've done, to help social causes in the world. You cannot help tea workers in Ceylon, Sri Lanka. And we have a project where we, for 28 years, we've used the profits from our businesses to help refugees save their ancient books, you know. Wow. And it becomes a cycle. You help other people make money. You create the seeds. Much more money comes into you, and then you have to turn it over again and do something good with it. But if you don't have that money, we've spent millions of dollars on this text project, and if we didn't have money, we couldn't help those people. So I think that's a beautiful combination. You have to be careful not to overwork and lose your meditation time, but you have to be careful not to over meditate and lose your touch with reality, with the real world, you know. So I think
I agree.
A balance of both is very beautiful.
My first business mentor is Sikh, and he came into my business and he said, "You are a blender without a top. You need to learn to meditate and put a lid on it. You'll never be successful."
But the combination is very beautiful. Most business people are not spiritual because they haven't found a spiritual path that makes sense to them.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you give them one, they're very happy. Definitely. And they're very successful.
So in completing our awesome conversation, I have so many new insights I can't wait to tweet about and all of that. But can we talk about the four steps and you call it a coffee meditation, but I'm going to call it a tea meditation because I'm drinking a beautiful cup of green tea right now. So can we leave our listeners with the four steps and the meditation?
Yeah, there's just something very, very practical. It comes from that ancient text, the same text. And there are four steps to planting a seed in your mind, which when it opens will change your reality. So there are two things we have to do. One is plant a seed. And then secondly, we have to make sure it opens in this lifetime. there are four steps. The first one is decide what you want in your life. Decide what's next in your life, what you want next in your life. And you know, over the course of many years of helping people, I think there are five goals that people want. One is financial independence. We would all like to be totally financial independent. Secondly, we'd like to have a great relationships, like a great partner and great family. Third, we all would like to have youthful energy and good health. And then fourth, I think all of us would like to have some kind of inner peace to go with the outside success. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, I think all of us would like to do something to serve the world. So those are the
Agreed.
Five goals. So you decide which of the five you'd like to work on. I would like to find a beautiful partner. I was in a relationship or I lost my partner, and now I'd like to find a beautiful partner. So that would be number one. You decide what you want very clearly. If you don't know what you want, you can do the four steps on finding out what you want. The second step would be to identify someone else who wants almost the same thing or something similar. So in the case of a partner, I always encourage people to go find a lonely person. And in my life, I've found that the nursing homes are completely filled to the brim with lonely people.
Wow.
If you would have to locate one. Step number two is to locate someone who wants what you want. If you want companionship and love, then you should find a lonely person. Then the third step is to spend 1 hour a week. And I encourage people to do it on Friday afternoon, because Friday afternoon is sort of a, I don't know, it's a good time of the week. You just, your mind is
people happy. Are stopping. They're not emailing anymore. People aren't expecting anything of you.
There isn't any work done in my offices around the world from 3 to 5 on Fridays. So we might as well do something else. And and you can go help them. You can go to the nursing home, pick up the... I have my own old lady. I've had her for 20 years. And you take her out. Take her out maybe to the movies or something like that. You do something to help the person get what you want. And that's step number three. And I really recommend doing it once a week for an hour. If you want to start a business, then on Friday afternoon, spend an hour helping someone else with their new startup.
Great.
And then the last step that you mentioned. So the first three steps, plant the seed. But again, that seed can stay in your mind for many years without opening if you don't water it. So the fourth step is to, we call it coffee meditation, but you can call it tea meditation. And there's a long story about why it's called coffee meditation. But basically, it means that you can relax at the end of your day. I encourage people to do it on their bed, just as they're about to go to sleep. You take your shower, change into your night clothes. And then just before you put your head on the pillow, or as you're putting the head on the pillow, you reflect on the kind thing that you did for the other person on Friday. And you think about it, and you think about all the details of it, and you have to think about it either until you fall asleep or until you have a good feeling about it. And then that good feeling about yourself in a healthy way, not in a prideful way, it waters the seed, and then that seed will grow very, very fast.
Wonderful.
So those are the four steps.
Wonderful. Well, Geshe Michael, thank you so much for this time. I know your time is precious. And for our listeners, the book is The Diamond Cutter, The Buddha on Managing Your Business and Your Life. I can't recommend it enough. It's changed my life. It's given context to the golden rule, and it has helped me be more abundant and profitable and more creative. And so I really highly recommend you guys go and grab it, The Diamond Cutter by Geshe Michael Roach. And once again, I'm Zena. You can find me on Twitter at Mistress of Tea, on Facebook at ZHENA. And let's keep this conversation going. I'd love to find out how The Diamond Cutter affects your life once you read it. And if you can be better than me and keep up with the 6-time book. I'm good at the circle day, but the 6-time book I'm not as good at. So thank you once again. Yeah, thank you once again, Michael Roach, and we will be in touch. And thank you for our listeners for spending this few minutes with us in gaining the knowledge of the ancient Buddhist text, The Diamond Cutter.